Welcome back to the Boltcast, your AMS2 podcast. I'm Steele, and with me is my co-host, Oz. Last episode, we had the opportunity to have a discussion with Todd Norbury of the Ryza Studios development team. If you missed it, check it out. This episode, we are literally back on track. We'll be doing a deep dive into patch 1220, and we have to start off with the 1974 Porsche RSR 3.0. Oz, welcome back, buddy.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Yeah, well, let's not make anybody wait here. Have you gotten some seat time in the RSR
yet? Yes, I have. In fact, today.
Awesome.
What a machine. It is probably not perfect as far as the implementation goes, but also really agreeable from my point of view anyway. It has... Oh, no. It's a crazy car, but...
Yeah,
it feels natural.
That was my first impression, was like how different it was. It just felt, it had that retro thing going on. It's almost noticeable as soon as you go through the first, you know, cornering section. It's it felt raw. You had to be deliberate with the car, like not modern. What I mean by retro was the opposite of like a GT3R. So this one is just feels like bare bones. Not, it wasn't designed with a computer, and it came across that way. And I think that's going to be a little bit unnerving for people when they first sit down in it. It was like one of those cars that I had to literally lap for hours just to get a handle on it. Did you feel the same way?
Funnily enough, it was completely natural from.
Okay, good.
From the first lap, I don't know why, but yeah.
So you have a connection with the RSR that was genetic, it appears.
It's my suspicion is that I have a really good connection with the AMS2 first feedback. I use the default first feedback, by the way. And
oh, really?
I do, yeah. And I think I just have a connection with that, and I'm a firm, not a believer, but like, personally, I really like when the FFB talks to me, tells me about what the rear is doing. And I'm not so big on hearing about the front tires. I don't really care, to be honest.
I've read about the force feedback being really more important for this car than a lot of other cars. There's that, you know, that wobbliness that it can, you can get at the corner exit, that the force feedback kind of encourages, I think, sometimes. So I found that if you anticipate the force feedback and make the steering adjustments before you get it indicated through your wheel, the car is a lot more compliant. Now, I have a T300, so mine isn't as fine as yours is, probably. But I think that is a factor to the car that can lead to some of the strange feeling. But for me, it was a learning curve, learning experience. But I should say that I started driving it way back a week ago when it was still in beta. And fortunately, I had the chance to do that. And so I got to see some of the development behind the scenes of the car. And, you know, it went through, I think, 3 iterations in beta. And the first one was like a really hyper soft setup. I think it was like 50-50 front and rear springs, which is a little bit crazy soft. So initially when I started testing it, I immediately had in the back of my mind to stiffen it up. So I did. I think what they have now as far as the default is concerned, spoiler alert, my build is coming out next Friday, but I stiffened it up a little bit from the beta, but the defaults now are actually stiffer than what I prefer, believe it or not, Oz. And I'm usually a pro stiffness kind of guy in race cars.
Stiffness,
but yeah, weird. I like the responsive feel of, you know, being able to get the car to react a little bit more. But I've always felt, and I've mentioned before, that the softer rear springs kind of hurt a lot of the cars. And this one, I think they went overboard with the rear stiffness. I mean, obviously, it's just personal preference. But what about the audio? Did you feel like the audio was on point?
Or I don't know how accurate it is or anything like that, but it sure sounds like a like a 911 from that era, like generally speaking. And that is actually one of those things where when I was on my first lap, I know it sounds like, no, you didn't actually do that, but I actually made like a few audible sounds, like noises, all by myself. It was just me here driving the car, but I made those noises. I'm not kidding. It was, I had to, like,
it was that because of like the grip, the slide.
It was all of the things. But the thing about 911s, and this is basically all of this in all of the sims I've ever driven, or any game basically, when you have these old 911s, the feeling of you have such nice long pulls when you go through the revs, if you know what I mean, because the gearing is pretty long. It would be even longer if this had only actually, does it? I think you have five gears. If it has five, four, sure. So I'm used to these things having four gears, and that's even better because you can just listen to the engine note. Just rise and rise and rise for multiple seconds. It's not like the modern 911, which just goes through gear so fast. The old ones, just there's something hair raising about the noise the engine makes, combined with the long pulls. And it's, you know, they've done the audio good when it manages to, I don't think it actually raised my hair, but it's, you know, hair raising is a way to put it. Yeah.
Right. No, I get it. I mean, it puts you in the car. That's what it's supposed to do. And they've actually hit you with that. So, or they hit it with that. So, the other thing that I really came to terms with and started to really just get in tune with was, the sliding that the car does. You're in the seat when you're driving it. Take a look at a replay. Anybody out there, you know, watch a trackside view, and the rear end, the rears are just sliding all over the place. And you can actually feel that when you're in the car. I've never felt more in tune with the rear of a car before. And like, it's like my mind was always concerned with what the rear of the car was doing at all times, in all phases, the corners, even when on brakes and things like that. So it was just so satisfying to be able to make a mistake and, like, say, pop down into first gear, and get the car would unhook, and you'd basically drift. And being able to manage that comfortably, and then getting the car back, it was just a phenomenal sensation for me with my experience in these era of cars. You obviously, you said it was in tune with you already, so you obviously have really good soft touch skills, because I like to hammer the throttle at times, and a car does not like that. So what other, you know, say you're speaking to someone that's a novice driver, say like a guy that's never, like me, never driven a retro GT before, you know, what is your approach? Like, how do you approach a corner? Let's just start from there.
Especially with these old 911s, you have to approach the apex in a weird way. You turn in early because you got to fight the understeer that this thing has. So make sure you can actually hit the apex. If you try to do it late, you're just gonna crash and burn. But if you hit the apex early, then what you're gonna do is get on the throttle gently, but also since it's a 911, you can get away with a lot of throttle. So the rear wheel stick, but in this case, it will also start to throttle oversteer. My suggestion is to try and hit the apex, turn into the apex early. Use trail braking to your advantage if you have to. Avoid first gear, if at all possible, because that'll give you all the lift off oversteer in the world. And that is actual liftoff oversteer, by the way. Then just incrementally try to get more on throttle earlier. try to learn that. Try to make use of the throttle oversteer, because what that will do for you actually is keep the car rotating and not like plow
okay
and get understeer out of the corner. So try to be smooth, try to be gentle, but at the same time aim for you kind of have to like take this car by the scruff of its neck and just like tell it what to do, like,
right,
just grab the car by the horns and be like, you're mine, this is where you will go next.
I felt the exact opposite. I felt like the car was telling me how it wanted to be driven. And as you got more time into it, it's sort of just like, okay, so this is what you like.
You know, sort of
like one of those circumstances.
You got to listen to the car, but at the same time, you got to become a 911 whisperer, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah. And then taking advantage of, or not taking advantage of, but anticipating what its needs are before it asks for it. Really does make a difference. When I was doing some testing, pretty hardcore testing last night, I was at Tosa. I think that was a good example of a sharper kind of hairpin. And yeah, you definitely want to approach the corner, but you want to rotate mid-corner appropriately. And then there is a tendency for the car to plow there. So you have to find that balance. Do you think that throttle braking is something that you would use with this car? You know, trying to like brake and throttle at the same time, or are you using one or the other as a technique? I tried throttle braking. It didn't really resonate too well. It has a tendency to just get too understeery at that point.
I didn't actually try that, but I basically did whatever I had to do to make the car turn, which is trail brake or just brake. Right.
Did you do any like throttle blipping? To try to get a little bit of lift off over steer for, say, like a high speed,
corner
where the nose is.
That also helps. Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff you can do with this car in terms of car control. It is really mad. So that's kind of what I mean is, you're correct in saying that you have to listen to the car, because it is telling it wants to do some crazy things. But at the same time, if it's trying to do those crazy things, you kind of have to just like step in and be like, nope, I'm in control, and do whatever is needed to, because you can control it. It's just trying to do all kinds of weird things when compared to a modern GT car. But you can definitely be in control, and that's, you kind of forget about, like, I guess you could drive it smooth, but what I'm saying is you have to dominate the car, is what I'm saying, because it's trying to do all kinds of stuff all the time, so you have to be the owner of the situation.
I can see where you're coming from there too. So your analogy is the opposite of mine, but it makes sense.
At the same time. Yes.
Kind of whip it into shape, you know. But it's definitely different than like a modern car, whereas, you know, the manual for the modern cars are more technical and specs and things like that.
Yeah.
And the cars do what you expect a modern car to do. This car, the manual is all, you know, driver techniques. It's probably, you know, 20 pages of, you know, this is when you want to try to induce liftoff oversteer. This is when you want to, you know, trail brake harder. This is where you want to turn and try to get some snap rotation, you know, late in the braking zone, like things like that. I just feel like this car has a lot more, it allows you to experiment with a lot more driving tools. You know, just from a, you know, driver's seat perspective than a modern car does, which I think is probably somewhat unnerving for, you know, someone new to them, and definitely was for me.
Yeah, sure. And that's actually even more to your point. You have to listen to the car, because I think it really rewards car control in the moment rather than trying to think like, okay, I imagine if you're trying to drive the car by expecting it to do something, for sure it generally does a thing, but it always seems to do it a bit differently. So what I'm saying is, it really rewards if you just listen to it constantly, and as I said, you just utilize car control and take control of the car, like, it,
right?
You're not so much like telling it what to do next, you're forcing it to do something and stopping it from doing some other thing.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of fighting going on with the car.
Well, that's a good point too. I think you have to let your hands go a little bit. And I've learned that with the Caterhams, and I felt like what I learned with the Caterhams with that is it resonates with this car as well. Just hitting the throttle and just seeing what happens and just letting your hands go free. Yes. Like, don't feel like you have to be mechanical when you're cornering like you would with a modern GT3. This time you engage the throttle and you just give it more and more and see what she can do with it. And then just let it loose, man. Let the wheel loose.
That is a really good,
And you can make mistakes in sim racing, you know, too. It's you can always just reset the car. It's not a $1 million machine that you're going to wreck, so you can push it for sure.
It is forgiving. If when the rear goes out, it's easy to catch. You just have to let the like you said, you just have to let the wheel loose. You have to apply opposite lock. But for sure, you can drive it like a. It's almost like a rally car, and the tires that it uses, Bias Bly. Bias Play tires. they are just
old school.
Old school tires. They have a lot of issues. Not like the technical implementation at the moment, but just like Bias Play in general. But what they have going for them is they're not really ever that sharp, and they have really forgiving wide slip angles, so you can have a pretty massive slide and it's still like okay.
Yeah.
It's probably not the fastest way to drive, but you don't have to, like,
and it's a wonderful feeling.
It is a wonderful feeling.
Slide.
You probably want to, you have to find the optimum amount of sliding. The fastest way is probably such that it looks pretty fantastic in the replay, but not like Tokyo Drift. Levels, but
I think, but it, looking at some of the data, the wheel slip angle is noticeably more than and controllable than you would get with a GT3. So
yeah, for sure.
I think a wheel slip for a GT3 would probably be pushing it if you're in the mid-teens. You know, 15% wheel slip is probably where I would say is you're probably over the wheel slip angle. But here it seems more like 15 to 20, and you're still right there and the car's right in your hands doing it. So the Bias Ply tires is something we should shout out Crimson Eminence for. He's been doing a lot of work on the forums trying to get everybody in tune with the different type of tire that AMS2 features with the RSR. So Crimson, thank you for, you know, all that work that you're doing and trying to educate people like me about what to expect with this thing. Because it definitely helps whenever I read Crimson's posts, they're always flagged in my mind, because you're going to learn something every time. So the ultimate point being, I think it's one of those cars that, you know, you have to take some time to it, especially if you're new to the era, and the car will come to you if you put in some time. But it's not one of those cars that, you know, if you don't have the experience jumping in, it's you know, and to make a judgment about how it should or should not feel. Trust me, it takes some practice, I know from personal experience. But you did mention that it might have some issues, but I think the positives far, far, far outweigh the negatives. And my initial impressions, although they were personal to me about how I was having difficulty with it, were quashed with practice. The more I practiced with it, the better the car became. So let's move on, Oz, to the new tracks or the iterations, starting with Salvador. Have you had a chance to spin around that track for a while?
Yeah, I gave that a quick go as well. It took me about maybe 5 laps to remember to slow down for the first. Well, actually, is it the first chicane? It's kind of. I don't know if it is.
It's really hard. You don't know where the start finish line is after what I would consider the first chicane. Because it's like the chicane right after the main straight, you know? So I always consider it turn one, even though it's probably the last turn. I don't know.
I got started from, you know, at a test day from the pit. So I have no idea, actually. I was lost. immediately. Like, I don't know where this track is going, where the start line is, but it doesn't matter. It's a, you know, it's a track. I don't have to know where I am. So
I loved it the first time. I drove it. I thought aesthetically it was really there, but then it felt like it was really on top of you the whole time. Like, you were always getting ready to do something. There's no brakes. Like, you can't just hit a straight and just, you know, take your one hand off the wheel. You have to be preparing for the next corner, especially with the RSR.
Yeah, that's true.
Those two things are kind of made for each other to learn how to drive the car. But it's aesthetically, you know, there was this effect that really struck me, and that was the banners waving. I don't know why something like that would really kind of hang in my mind, but you're going down this long boulevard with lined with trees and banners are waving in the breeze. It just struck me as just like I was there in a certain way. And then the retro sound of the RSR, it just felt so right to me. But it's got that bumpy street thing going on. It had like a long beachiness to it. Not quite as Long Beach as Long Beach, but definitely had that sensation there, especially on those long high speed corners, right? They have some bumps along those corners that can really upset the RSR if you're not careful. Did you drive it with the RSR I didn't even ask. Which car did you drive it with?
I drove it in the RSR. And I have to say about the bumps as well, it feels old school bumpy, like old school AMS2 bumpy before. Like, it, unlike Long Beach, which is where the bumps feel like mistakes, or not mistakes by the track team, but like mistakes by people who laid down the tarmac at Long Beach in real life, or like just, you know, beaten by the California, I won't say California weather, but California sun, climate, whatever. Just the way streets just get bumpy by themselves. But whereas Salvador just feels like it was never really smooth in the first place.
Right. I think Long Beach, you can feel like the track is sort of like a street circuit that became like a really overused track. Like, the bumps are right where, like, there's a lot of like friction going on between the tarmac and tires on those corner exits. Whereas in Salvador, you know, I don't think it's a really that old of a track. It's only, you know, it was from 2009. So it doesn't feel like it's been beaten down by race cars so much as it was, you know, just a street track that, you know, could just so happened to be a race track today. But the other thing was the chicanes. They are a trick in the RSR, man, I tell you, especially the one with the sausage curbs. It feels like it's one car width wide. And I did some racing there. It's not pretty, dude. Especially if the AI are just not going to handle that very well, I tell you what. So I would recommend staying away from racing there.
Yeah, I can.
What do you think?
I didn't try. I didn't try against AI, but I can imagine it being a bit of a Long Beach show.
Yeah, can imagine three wide
initially until they
going into that chicane.
Yeah. But you know what?
And then launching off the curbs.
Yeah, that as well. Actually, I only spun the RSR twice. First time was at Laguna Seca. I'm not gonna go back to the RSR too much. Just making a point here. I spun it at Laguna Seca because I was overdriving it, clearly getting the rear tires overheated, which someone had a good point. Takes a lot of doing with the bias ply tires. But and the other time I spun is when I was like, okay, now I'm gonna actually take that chicane fast and ride the curbs. Nope. Set the RSR.
Didn't like it.
No, did not like
it. Yeah, I think you can nibble the actual curbs, but if you try to nibble some of the sausage, it's not gonna like it. You're definitely gonna be out of shape. You're gonna lose time doing it. You know, some corners you can get away with getting some sausage. Sounds weird saying, but you can get away with it. But in that particular circumstance, it just gets the car way too out of shape, and you just can't get the power down effectively. So it'll hurt you ultimately. What about CASKS, the alternate format. Did you try that?
I didn't try that, but we were... I've raced there a couple times, and I've seen, and you could actually, if you didn't care about track limits, you could actually, I think, take that alternate layout route around the...
Really?
Yeah, the trickiest, they got the trickiest hairpin chicane thing, whatever that thing is.
it's like so the opposite of long Laguna Seca. It's like you're going uphill instead of...
Yeah, but also like... everything's going on there, and you could like see that there was like a year ago already. I think I was racing it in the Fusca or something, and with Mooney GT, dropping another mention. You could see that. Oh, but there's this nice route around the. Don't get me wrong. It is. I think it is a. It's a nice hairpin to approach because you're like braking hard and you're trying to learn how to.
It's just a technical component there. The problem is, I think people don't like it is because the cars don't like it.
The cars don't like it.
Get over the crest of the. You get over the crest of the hairpin. You think you're done, and then all of a sudden you're unloading, and your rears don't ever want to settle back down. And you know it's a technique kind of corner, but I know that the getting rid of it is, you know, it's well received. People really love the alternate, it's all positives as far as I'm concerned. I'd probably be more conservative and say that I like them both. In a track where, you know, you're trying to get as many passing opportunities as you can, that's a really quick way to pick up a spot. If someone gets that little sector wrong, you can maybe pick up a position if you get it right. But on the other hand, if you get it wrong, you might lose a position. So there's an argument both ways. What about the Interlagos change? They added another track for, I think, the stock car variant. But I didn't really notice any difference as far as the layouts are concerned between that and the GP circuit. Did you notice anything?
I don't think the layout is supposed to be any different.
Right. Okay.
But I'm kind of confused about which one was the original layout in AMS2, because the changelog says added alternative Interlagos stock car GP and GB variants. Mm-hmm. And it says that the latter features temporary grandstands from the GP weekend. And I also noticed that at least the map in the menu, only the GP layout has the DRS, the DRS zones.
Right, that's a good question. So, I didn't actually even look into that, but I noticed that the DRS was the difference.
Yeah, and I don't know where these grandstands are. I was actually meant to try it, but I went to try the stock car layout and got stuck testing the car instead. I forgot about the... Because I was, we'll get back to that, but I was so interested in the car that I was driving for some other changes. But yeah.
So you weren't looking for that grandstand? You were trying to actually drive the car? Shame on you.
Yeah, but let's just say that this is a nice, if they can do things like this, like just let's create this variant like real quick. If the track team can do that, I mean, with the spare time they have between bigger tasks. This is, I think, a good idea. I would love to see more of this, especially the Cascais alternate layout was like, yeah, finally. Even though I haven't tried it, yeah. So it's good that they add these variants if they can. And there's probably more.
Is Cascais going to be one of those tracks where if you're like the host of a lobby and you put in the chicane version, everyone's going to be groaning in the chat box?
Probably. No, I want the other one. But I feel this.
No,
I feel
not
that,
the chicane.
Yeah, but I feel that. I understand because I feel the same way about Jerez, where the one with the chicane just forget about it. I love the what is it called? Is it the MotoGP layout or something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
I love that. I don't want. Yeah, I don't want to have a bloody chicane there. Like, take it away.
I like the chicane.
No. Forget about the chicane.
Don't you think it's too fast? Otherwise,
too fast.
Just kidding.
Get out of here.
Let's get into some of the other technical components of the patch. And the first thing that stands out in my mind is the multiple controller profiles. Now, you have multiple rims. I don't. So you might, this might impact your quality of life way more than mine. So describe what they did here.
So, yeah, really, like, they just dropped this. They mentioned this in the QA a couple months back, that this is coming, I think, in the short term. There will be, in the near future, they will do something about multiple rims. And I think this is actually a really good way of doing it. I mean, I don't actually know any other way of doing it, actually, to support multiple rims. The reason you have to have, I'll explain my situation. The reason you have to have a system for this is, for sure, you can use multiple rims. I could use all of my two or three rims before, but the problem is that I have fanatic. How do you actually pronounce it? Fanatic? Anyway.
Fanatec. I always thought it was Fanatec.
Doesn't matter.
Never put that much thought into it in the first place.
Yeah. Porsche. There's a
Porsche.
It's
gonna really rile some feathers there.
Porsche. Okay.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have an F1 rim from Fanatec, and it has all the buttons you could ever need. And I also got the advanced paddle module for it, which adds even more buttons. And a lot of the buttons are actually shared with other rims, in the sense that they also exist. The button number exists in the other rims, but mine have always been a bit weird. Where if I bind something to be right there under my thumb, it's like in another place when I use my Porsche 918 rim. And
okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So that's the first thing. The other thing is the F1 rim has, and you want to make use of these, right? Because you have these these different dials. I don't use the numbered dials at all, but I do use the dip switches and the I don't know if they're called dip switches, but they look a bit like dip switches. And I use those, and I use the thumb rotary whatever things that are right there next to your thumbs. So I use those, and those are non-existent in the 918 rim, or basically most round rims.
And gotcha.
Yeah, so that has actually been an issue where if I want to change brake bias, for example, and I've set it to the thumb thing on the F1 rim, it's not bound to anything when I use the round rim. And I can for sure,
oh, I see,
I can go and change that stuff, but after, I don't really do that. Like, it's such a small thing to having to go to the settings and change those, but it's so inconvenient. I just sound like
well, yeah, I mean, if you're in a session and you just want to drive another car for another reason, you have to go back and do your key binding. It's a pain. Now you can just switch your profile name, and you should be good to go. Switch your rim, switch your... you could even do it if you have just one rim. You can have different, profiles for cars that have onboard ABS. Like,
that's true.
Perfectly reasonable.
That's true. Like, you could... Actually, that makes a lot of sense. For GT3, for example, you could... because it doesn't have DRS and boost, you could actually make use of those buttons for something else. Why not?
Yeah, traction control, brake bias. Those are the ones that I'm planning on using.
And another big thing that I've been doing, because I've been, when I took pictures for cars of AMS2, I went and just used a game pad and drove around a bit to get just to get enough material for the replay to get a nice picture. That was just way more handy. But to do that, I had to get into this session where I just basically destroyed my good wheel bindings and bound the gamepad. But now what I could do is have another profile that's for picture taking. So or like a gamepad profile is what I'm saying. Which is also I think nice, and like because of the inconvenience is not a barrier by any means, but it is a surprisingly big barrier having to redo your wheel settings and all that. So now that if I don't have to do that anymore, I could it's easier for me to get into photo mode or just launch AMS2, and you know, I'll drive around in some nice weather and take pictures, get some more high quality, like if I want to refresh Cars of AMS2 photos.
You're saving yourself time with basically all it's really doing. It's saving everyone time and aggravation. But let's move into the next topic, which is the traction control. Do you think they've, you know, put a bookend on traction control? Are we done? They've introduced the button bindings for the incremental traction control system. So does that mean that we're moving away from that as an issue anymore? I mean, this is a big time thing for me, at least for GT3 drivers.
Yeah. I've been looking forward to this as well. Like this update is actually surprisingly big from a quality of life point of view. It's just like, I don't know if you can even call it that, but just fixing a couple longstanding like features, adding those. So you can now finally change traction control and ABS. Or like you can finally set those to buttons. So you have an increase and decrease for both traction control and ABS.
Right.
And what it does is exactly the same thing as you could do via the in-car management thing, which was always a pain in the
wonky.
Yeah, pain in the ass to work with, and.
I crash 50% of the time I try to use that thing.
I was actually going to say...
Either that or I lose like 5 seconds of track time just trying
to... Yeah, I was actually going to say that maybe the reason they added... It's not coincidence that they added the TC and ABS increment buttons now, because maybe Renato tried to... drive a GT car at Salvador, and he was like, when do I like he tried to manage TC on a straight at Salvador.
Yeah, there's no time in Salvador. There's absolutely
he was just
no
fumbling with the ICM, just crashing. Like
so, but also on the side note is you know, GT3s are a very popular class in a lot of different sims, and especially with the number one GT3 sim ACC traction control on the wheel is almost requirement. And I think even if you were going to be drawing players from that sim to try AMS2, the fact that it wasn't on the wheel, and the fact that it was a percentage based system probably was so like off putting, you know, from that quality of life or, you know, immersion kind of factor, realism, whatever you want to call it. The fact that it's going to be just part and parcel of the game now. We're not going to be talking about it that much anymore, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's new players are going to come over, and it's going to be just what they expected. And there you go. Done. No conversation needed. The only thing that I think they need to refine with it is they have to have it lined up with the visual of the dash. Like, so if you have the dash, the LED display or whatever you call it on the actual wheel that's rendered in the game, if it actually coordinates with the settings that you set, that would be really, really cool. But right now, we just have to rely on the white alert, the white words that pop up on the screen.
Yeah, the messages.
Just like you would before with brake. Yeah, exactly. So let's move into some cars other than the RSR. Now, you've been away for the week. Have you had a chance to drive any other cars, you know, with the new 122? 2.0 update.
Yeah, I did try, because Salvador gave me some strong DTM vibes. So I, because it's not quite like, what's that? Is it called Norris Ring? I forget what it's called, but there's this like classic street circuit that they, I think they drive the, they used to drive or still drive the DTMs at. But the DTM 92 or Group A, Salvador had such DTM 92 vibes that I had to give the Group A Mercedes a go.
I was not hoping you'd bring up Group A. Group A is polarizing right now, man.
Yeah, it's. I'm just gonna say it's probably still a bit of a work in progress, but I would say that it's. The default setup is probably, I don't know what exactly is there's still something off about it, but I will say that it's now, I think it is in the ballpark, because previously it was just kind of, when he got on the throttle, trying to get out of a corner, it was just weird, because the tires had I think it was confirmed that the, there was something off with the tires, and basically now it feels smoother. It doesn't grab as much. It doesn't have as much one tire fire, but at the same time, it still feels like, well, this could be better, especially after you've driven something so nice as the. I mean, every car is different, but it kind of feels like maybe it's still. Work in progress, but
right. Which one would you recommend someone that hasn't driven a Group A to jump into? Oh, which one do you think is the better iteration?
I didn't try
the Mercedes or the BMW.
No, see, I didn't try the BMW at all this time. I just like the Mercedes because it at least used to be, it used to be the one that was spent more time sideways, not like completely sideways, but a bit sideways, you know.
My impression is the BMW is a little bit more quirky than the Mercedes.
Maybe, yeah.
So probably a little bit higher learning curve. But if you wanted me to do a build, which one would you want me to do first? The Merc, then?
Yeah, the Merc.
I need to jump into them. I've neglected the DTMs, and I know that they've been out there, so.
Do the Merc and pick the Berlin livery with the Finnish flag.
Okay.
You got to go for that one.
I think the Merc is sort of like the poster child of DTM. Like, I know the BMW is in the category, but like every picture I see referenced about DTM or Group A, it's always the Merc.
It's basically like,
so that's a good choice.
It looks like a sleeper with stickers on it. Obviously, it
looks cool,
but yeah, it's I don't know. There's something weird about that, like old. Like, that sort of Mercedes just doesn't look like a race car at all normally.
No, it looks like a production car that they kind of just racified.
Yeah. It's such a, there's something cool about that. It has grown on me. I used to think that it looked really dumb, but it has grown on me. The sleeper value of the thing, yeah,
right.
But
you take the wing off, the spoiler off the back, and then you lower the rear ride height, and you can go get groceries in it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I'd also remove the stickers because I don't think anyone actually drives around with a Sonax car.
That would be sweet, though. Imagine you'd be the first, like, just drive like a get a street legal DTM, old school 1990s DTM, and just drive around. People would just probably be more confused than anything else.
It would be confused.
But you'd be the only one thinking how cool you are.
Imagine driving that down the street at night, just like everything, like on a peaceful street. And then you hear the scream of the engine, like.
Wake up, everybody. Yeah. Did you try, I think the big one of this update, though, the big change, I think they were both in the Group A's and the M1 Pro Car were mentioned as having like major tire tread revisions. Did you try the M1 Pro Car?
I did, yeah. I think that as well is now it's in the gray area where I think maybe it needs setup work, but It has such a, it had such a lack of throttle oversteer, had a lot of one tire fire before, I think. Whereas now it feels like maybe the diff settings, which we cannot affect apart from the clutches, I think. Maybe those still need to be looked at.
Just the clutches.
And then suspend. Yeah, we can only, yeah. And then maybe the suspension defaults need to be looked at as well, or something like that. Because the, as we talked about some episodes ago, suspension has a lot of, obviously a lot of,
yeah,
affects the car in a big way. So kind of still feels a bit weird, but I will say though that it reminds me more of the race room version now, where it has just vast amounts of understeer at high speed. Like, you're right, thinking surely I can make this corner, but like, nope, because it because the bias ply.
No, I tires. Think that's.
I'm not sure.
I think
about
you're right.
That. Yeah,
it's a different feeling car almost altogether, and I think that the setup work is going to, you know, I've done some work on it. I'm planning on doing a refined build on it, and so far, everything that I've wanted to change on the car is represented. But the difference between the older version and this one are almost night and day.
Yeah.
The way you approach corners is a lot different when you have to expect a massive amount of understeer. And so I've already kind of started playing with the springs already to try to get that initial corner entry bite, at least just a little bit to get the car started on the rotation. Before, I think you had to rely almost on like the brake bias rotation and the differential unlocking to get any turning done. But this one seems a little bit better, just naturally having the car rotate. But it is a heavy car. The tire walls are probably stiffer, and it goes a lot faster now. Did you notice the speed difference between the two the versions?
Oh, I actually didn't. No, I haven't paid enough attention to the top speed.
It's about 30 meters longer at Imola at the first corner. You have to brake like a light year before you used to be able to brake, because the front would just plow in, and then you have to just kind of slowly ease off of it when you're turning into that first corner. If the car's not biting then, that's when I would look at the setup being the cause. And I think that would be the front springs would be the first thing that I'd be looking at there. Yeah. Other than that, I think I was also working on the Aussie Racing Camaro. That's one of your favorites, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a sleeper car, a little mini Super V8. It's got a spool in it, but it doesn't feel like the Super V8 does because it doesn't have as much power.
Yeah, it's
so it's a lot more.
Yeah, maybe even the doesn't have as. I mean, the with the torque or the power delivery is way different because it uses a, I think it uses a motorcycle engine, so.
It does.
It's so, but the thing is, it's not like, because in the Super V8 you could kind of just look at the throttle pedal and the car is already spinning. Whereas with this, it's more of a, you gotta rev it really to get any torque going. Yeah. I think.
You could definitely notice the spool with the Super V8. It's sort of like it takes over the conversation of the car. The way the choppiness, you know, when you see the inside tires biting when you're cornering. And then obviously the oversteer tendency on exit, but this car had it more subtle ways and more controllable ways. Like it wasn't going to kill you like the Super V8 has a tendency to try to do.
Yeah.
But those are some, that was something I have, I already made a few changes with the Aussie Racing Camaro that I think are really, really good. I know it was good before, so I shouldn't say that it wasn't good. Like a lot of times when I do setup work, it's not. Not to say that the defaults are terrible, but the thing that I want to put an asterisk on is the fact that when I'm making the setups, I'm bringing the cars to me a little bit. So my driving style comes through with some of the setups. And as my driving style, you know, evolves and I get better with different types of cars, you know, I might go back to a car that I previously liked and change it even further. So that's a thing. But yeah, the ARC is definitely a car that I would recommend.
Oh, yes.
All right, Oswald, that's about all I had for this week. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
I just wanted to mention bias ply tires, and that's about it.
Okay. Bias ply. Do you mean bias ply as in bias ply?
Yeah, that's. I think that's what I said. Bias ply. Did you?
Okay.
Did you get that?
Bias ply. I just want to make sure you were saying bias ply. All right, guys. Have a good one. Thanks again. I wanted to take a brief moment before we let you go to reflect on the incident at Brands Hatch this past Saturday. Rob Foote, a volunteer marshal, was struck and killed as a result of an on-track incident. As you know, most of the marshals and track personnel are just avid race fans with families. To know that the inherent danger of motorsports can sometimes turn a wonderful sport into a tragedy is a personal shock to me every time I hear that it happens. I encourage everyone here to visit the Just Giving page link in the description below and offer any support that you can to help Mr. Foote's family through this tragic time. And with that, thank you again for watching, and take care.